My guest today was born in Uganda and was brought up in Britain. He's an award-winning writer and a documentary filmmaker. He comes from an illustrious creative family that has very much made his own mark, particularly in literary fiction. He's won the Somerset Maugham Award and been shortlisted for America's prestigious National Book Award. His new novel, The Secret Books, is utterly compelling and so relevant to our times. Marcel Theroux, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thanks for having me.
Just such a lovely book to start off with. The Secret Books, it's called. It's just come out and it is wonderful. I think it's your sixth book.
It is my sixth book, yes. It was slightly alarming. Suddenly you've got this long list of books after your name. It's kind of, you keep publishing them so you can look after the family together.
You write in this book, the protagonist realises that writing's not a career, it's a series of crises.
I think that's true. I think when I began writing my first book, 1996, I think I sat down to start writing it. And I had a fantasy that you published a book and then you got welcomed into this glittering antechamber and the rest of your life really panned out with, you know, writing more books and, you know, that there was a kind of structure to it and you graduate to, I don't know, and after a certain length of time you become Ian McEwan. It just isn't like that. It's like a kind of...
You've got too much hair to be Ian
McEwan. I'm glad I'm ahead of him on one thing. No, but it just isn't. I think that from the outside looking in, it appears that there's a career to it. But it was funny, my dad said, when I published my first book, my dad said, see, now your problems are just beginning.
Well, of course, because of course you've got a role model in this because your father is Paul Theroux, who is a fantastic, very well-known and very successful travel writer.
Well, see, but that's a very confusing role model to have because if you look at my dad, you think, oh, okay, so that's how it is. You go up, you write, do morning writing, you eat fish finger sandwiches, you go kayaking in the afternoon and you get a very nice career out of it. But actually, for, I think, 99% of writers is quite different. You inevitably end up doing other things to support yourself, which I've come to believe is a good thing, actually. I believe that writing makes you go crazy. That's empirically based on a lot of writers that I know. I think it's very important to get out of the study often and encounter normal human beings doing normal jobs. And
it was your father's job, of course, that meant that you were born in Uganda.
Right, it was my father's job as a teacher, because both my parents, my mum's British and my dad's from the States, and they both did, my dad was a Peace Corps volunteer, my mum did VSO, and they met out in Africa as English teachers in the late 60s. You know, I feel like being born in Uganda is the most interesting thing about me, but I was only there for 6 months. I remember nothing about it, so I feel slightly fraudulent. But, it's a fact. I was born there, but I have no real connection to the place.
Your father wrote children's books as well as great adult writing, and that must have been some kind of an inspiration.
Well, my dad, he turned his hands to lots of different kinds of writing, and very successfully, travel books and novels. He even wrote a play. I'm really fond of his children's books. I think he wrote two, London Snow and A Christmas Card. But I have to say, as a child, my taste was for a different kind. I liked more, you know, slightly more fantastic, imaginative worlds than the ones that I felt. I wanted my dad to write something a bit crazier. Now I really appreciate those books, though. I think they're really lovely.
So reading, obviously, a big part of your life from very early on. You went to Cambridge and to Yale.
Yeah, I did. And I studied English literature, which, looking back on it, I think may be a handicap for a writer. It really encourages you to use that sort of analytic side of your brain, what I think of as the internal critic, because that's the one thing you never discuss at university studying English literature. You never talk about story or how to write a good story. You talk about themes. You try and position works in a kind of idea of canonical literature. And so when you decide you want to write something and you sit down, you've got this heavily muscled internal critic and a rather weedy creative side who you have to then kind of nurture and bring up to be at least as strong as the internal critic. Otherwise, you're never going to get anything done.
Of course, you didn't initially go straight into writing. You did a lot of other jobs. You worked in television news in America.
That's right, I did. After I did international relations at Yale, as a reaction to doing English literature, I thought I needed to do something that was quote-unquote useful and about the real world. And after that, I went to work for a couple of different TV stations. And one of my early jobs was writing news for CBS This Morning, was writing copy. And I really enjoyed it. It was a weird overnight job. You know, you'd go in at 8 in the evening and come back on the subway at 6 in the morning and write things that would then come out of Paula Zahn or Harry Smith's mouth. And they were quite... They were then, you know, the big anchors for the morning news. And I found it was weirdly exciting, but also so antisocial. And ultimately, I think I was yearning to write something more creative. But it was kind of fun. It would have been a career if I'd stuck at it.
I mean, American news seems to me very, very different from the way we do things here.
Yes, it is. Even then, I think I saw that, and that I remember coming back and watching the BBC news after being in the States and just thinking, God, they actually look like normal people. Whereas American news reporters, and I worked with a few of them, you know, they have this kind of great voice and they have this great smooth appearance. Well, Georgina, let's look at it. Likely, you know, and you think, wow, that's sort of, even given that they're speaking an American accent, there's something slightly kind of fake about it. Whereas you see a sort of BBC reporter standing out looking pasty with bad teeth and you think, God, they really know their stuff.
In your book, Strange Bodies, which examines the sort of mysteries of consciousness, I suppose, you say that language is essential to the construction of consciousness. And then later in The Secret Books, you say that the protagonist has a slight transformation. There's a slight transformation that each language kind of wreaks on his character.
But I do think that, do you speak other languages, Georgina?
Not well, muddle
through French, Italian, something
exactly.
like that. But don't you feel when you speak, I don't speak Italian, I speak Spanish with an Italian accent, and that sort of does, that seems to help. But you just feel a bit different. And Russian in particular, I feel a bit different, you know, when I speak what Russian I can. So I am interested in that and how you can... It's just like from experience, I know that there's a sort of firmness about Russian that I don't have when I speak English.
Yeah, that's so interesting. When you look at other books, so for instance, your book Far North has been translated into German and Dutch and French.
Yes.
And of course, a Japanese edition that Murakami.
Haruki Murakami translated it, yeah.
Which is, I mean, fabulous.
I know.
How great is that?
It was really amazing. That was really one of the amazing things that happened to me in my writing career, that I heard that he'd read the book and not only liked it, but wanted to translate it into Japanese. And the Japanese edition is very beautiful. They just did it really nicely. And yeah, so I've met him once. And I know he was a big fan of the book. And, you know, that I'll be eternally grateful to him for that.
Far North is just one of your six books, as we were talking about. And I wonder how your novel writing career sort of interlaced with your television career, because we should talk about that. You've also done a lot of work on TV.
Yes, I've made a lot of documentaries. At the moment, I make about two a year for a strand called Unreported World on Channel 4, which I really love doing. And they're very intense eight-week contracts. And I think when I was much younger, I told you when I wrote my first book, I sort of imagined that I would then, you know, I'd be given a tweed jacket and a desk in the London Library, and then I would devote the rest of my life to turning out a novel a year. And clearly that isn't what, there's no model for a writing career. No one knows, who honestly knows what's going to happen next. But I feel very lucky to be able to combine it with another kind of work I love, which is completely different, which is gregarious, which involves meeting people, which involves collaborating, which is also painful, because if you have it all your own way in a novel, it can be strange then to write a script and have people go, no, that's basically crap. Have another go. But I think it's good for your preciousness about your writing to realise that, you know, sometimes you just have to roll your sleeves up and work with other people. But I think the great thing about it as well, and how it's had a bearing on Far North in particular and The Secret Books, is that it's exposed me to situations that I wouldn't have experience of otherwise. I'm thinking in Far North that it really was, that was born out of several trips to Northern Siberia. And I can't say it's a place I know well, but it's a place that I've been to and spent months meeting, you know, Evin reindeer herders and visiting locations that are truly bizarre to me. And I think if you want to write fiction, that's a huge advantage to be able to have license to go to these places and then ask people questions and see how people live.
I mean, another subject you've investigated in some detail is climate change.
That's right. I made a documentary in 2004 about climate change for Channel 4. And that was a seed for Far North as well. And we travelled then to Chernobyl and to Alaska to witness climate change and to also to talk to scientists. And one of the people we met was James Lovelock, the climate scientist, the man who came up with the Gaia hypothesis, the idea that you could consider the world to be a self-sustaining organism. And he's an amazing, inspirational sort of maverick, and slightly, I think he's a controversialist as well, but also he's passionate about climate change. And looking back, 2004, it was clear then that it was a huge problem. And I wanted to write something about it, and I was struggling to find a way, but eventually I did, and it was Far North was the book that came out of those thoughts.
Mm. I mean, we're recording this as Florida is bracing itself for Hurricane Irma, and of course the Caribbean, great swathes of the Caribbean have been wiped out over the last couple of days.
Right, not to mention the hot summers that we've had. And no one can point at any individual event and say it's climate change. And also, we might add that we have a climate skeptic sitting in the White House, and we have the bizarre spectacle of China seeming like the...
Suddenly the world leader.
The leader on climate change, yes. Which says something about the pragmatism of the Communist Party, whatever else all their other faults are. They don't seem completely blind to reality.
I mean, your climate change film was very important, and I'm just surprised that we aren't being deluged by stuff like that right now.
I feel like there's a sort of ambient exhaustion with the subject of climate. People understand it's a problem. People don't know what to do. I think it's, you run the risk of just making people feel bad. It's deeply depressing. I don't even know what to say about it. I felt depressed when I was writing Far North, which was in 2006. Mm. That was more than 10 years ago.
So your books, A Stranger in the Earth, then Paper Chase, which was the one that won the Sunset Moon Award.
I think of that as my first real book, in a way. I think of A Stranger in the Earth as my sorcerer's apprenticeship. I sat in a room and wrote a book and learned a lot. I mean, it was the only book I could have written then, but I think I had a lot of learning to do.
Mm.
And that's the thing I think about my dad, actually. I was looking at how many books he'd written before Mosquito Coast. So many. And I was thinking the same thing about V.S. Naipaul, you know, who wasn't published properly in the States until he was 40. And I was thinking in those days, writers, perhaps this is an illusion, but it feels like in those days, writers were given a long lead time. Many years to serve an apprenticeship. No one expected them to come out of the gates with a masterpiece. You published a sort of okay book, and then you published another, and you sold enough to lending libraries, and no one expected to make a lot of money. And I think that's an important fact. You know, you do need to learn how to do this and make mistakes. And probably now more mistakes end up in the top drawer than end up in bookshops. Mm. I think that's a change that's happened.
Yeah. Just talking about your father's work for a moment, has there ever been any kind of resentment from you or your brother, Louis, also a filmmaker, about being kind of grist to his literary mill, the fact that you do appear in ways in his books?
Well, it's funny. I mean, we've grumbled about it together, Lou and I, but I think mainly we find it funny. You know, there was a composite character who was the son of the sort of the dadoid character in one of his, you know, Romana Clay books. And both Louis and I claimed that it was kind of unflattering. But I said it was Louis. Louis claims it's me. It's definitely Louis, by the way. Just for the record. If I think about it too hard, I think it is quite weird to use your family like that. But it's been going on so long that I'm used to it. And of all the kind of embarrassing things, I mean, aren't parents just so embarrassing anyway? You know, isn't that just another form of parental embarrassment?
Yeah. Well, I think you're probably right. I mean, is it a burden at all having this really quite unusual name and then everybody associated with it seems to have done absolutely brilliant things? I mean, how great that you're successful. How crushing if you hadn't been.
Well, it's all relative, isn't it? I mean, do you take my family as the sample set? I'm really not successful at all. You know, it's how you look at it. I think it's a privilege, actually.
Let's talk about living in Tooting, because you don't so much use your own family as use yourself, particularly in this book. And one of the things I love about your latest book, The Secret Books, is about how it's your own life story. It's you at the end of your tether, unable to start your novel, and you're at Tooting Lido, and it's kind of about your life. And then it slips into this other story. It's amazing the way you've done it. In acting, I suppose that would be sort of breaking the fourth wall.
Right. Oh, I'm glad you think that, because I agonised about that and thought it was self-indulgent at times. But the seed of The Secret Books sprang out of a true story. I was fascinated by the life of this Russian journalist called Nicholas Notovich, who in 1894 published a gospel that he said he'd found in a monastery in Ladakh. And this gospel showed that Jesus had studied Buddhism in India during his missing years. I've been reading this book, I've been researching Notovich's life. I was thinking, who on earth is this Russian guy who was in the British Empire at this fraught time? What was he doing there? Was Jesus studying Buddhism in his missing years? And I was fascinated by this, and I couldn't find a form in which to tell the story. And I flirted with writing it as non-fiction or doing a straight biography. And then I thought, I know I want it to be a novel because I want to bring Notovich back to life. And I really want to question him about this. And I tried again and again, and more by luck than judgment, I ended up with this, telling it in the form that I have. And I think I justify it to myself by saying that The Secret Books is a book about storytelling. It's about how all stories are self-serving, and all stories, however professional seeming, however much they claim to have a kind of scientific legitimacy, actually made by sweaty human beings with their own agendas. Mm. And I kind of wanted to enact that with The Secret Books and show how my own novel arose. I wanted to show you the kind of struggle that goes into the creating of a book so that you could then see Notovich's book and wonder about it in the same way.
But it's such a great device, and it just really makes the reader so involved, because you do absolutely directly address us. It really works. It's a kind of...
Well, when I've written novels, I've always had a book alongside it, a kind of a diary where I put in doubts and I put in plot ideas and I put in suggestions to myself that I think I'll carry out further down. I'm sure lots of people do this. And I give myself pep talks, or I just whinge. And sometimes when I read those afterwards, I think, God, this is really interesting. It's like a kind of... It's like the record of someone really struggling with a complex question. I mean, maybe not interesting to everyone, but I think that they have a weird energy to them. And I always suspect that one of the things that readers really engage with in a book, and what I certainly do on an unconscious level, is the struggle the author is having within the book to tell the story. And I thought, maybe share more of that with the reader. I think readers might be intrigued by that.
Another fantastic device you use all the way through is that you throw in complete anachronisms.
Right. Well, that was a kind of Marmite thing. You know, some people have really hated those, I have to say.
So, I mean, for example, you'll talk about Pussy Riot when you're talking about Russia, but, you know, 200 years before
it happened.
Yes, that's
right.
Or Twiglets, or going to Catford.
That's right. A couple of people told me to take those out. And it's one of those things it's one of those kill your darlings moments where you think, like, maybe they're right. What on earth have I done? But I felt, this is going to sound weird, but the book, I feel, changes gear. It goes from a point where someone is struggling to write a book to a point where what I think of as the enchantment kicks in. And I feel like people don't talk about that enough about fiction, that there is a moment where some magic happens and some other reality is evoked and you're plunged into it and you don't worry that it's fiction. It's vivid. It's a vivid, continuous dream. And in that vivid, continuous dream, which you're trying to inhabit and then trying to transmit to the reader, these were the things that I saw. I didn't exactly see Paris in the 1880s, 1890s. I saw a version of it that wasn't exactly the same.
In which people can say, hey, check out my blog.
Right. And so I fretted about that. But then I was thinking, it reminds me a bit of, you know, the Derek Jarman Caravaggio, which I think probably for budget reasons, he wasn't able to make absolutely Renaissance Italy, and there are anachronisms in that, and you can hear traffic noises in the background. But then I was also thinking, there's a book of poems by Geoffrey Hill called Mercy and Hymns, which is about offer, a Dark Age king of the Midlands. But he also puts in lots of weird things like playing snakes and ladders with his granny and going on school trips. And there's something about this utterly charming. But, and also interesting because it makes, instead of history suddenly seeming really remote, you think, we're still in history. This is a history that's continuous, that comes down to the present day. And really, don't fool yourself that now is any different. Don't fool yourself that you're wiser or less deluded than these people running around in the 1880s or the 1580s or 880. It's all the same.
Yeah, and fake news existed then as it exists now. I suppose one of the biggest themes through this is the atavistic shriek of anti-Semitism, as you describe it, and the book The Protocols, which, again, you say, a warrant for genocide.
A warrant for genocide.
And the fact that Notovitch was completely discredited, probably because of this.
Well, that's right. At the time he comes back from India with his gospel, it's also the time that the mother of all fake news stories begins to circulate the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which people either have never... Sometimes I get a blank face when I say it to people, or other people know exactly what I'm talking about. But it's a conspiracy theory that suggests that a cabal of Jews are behind a sinister plot to control the world. And if that's familiar to you, that's because you've seen a similar thing in, you know, every James Bond film. Take away the Jewish theme. But the idea of a sinister elite, whether it's Freemasons or Jews, behind everything, which is unfortunately still current. And the weird thing is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion still has a currency, and if you Google it, you'll see people who still think it's true, even though it's 100% discredited. And I thought, how extraordinary, because in the end, whether people believe a thing or not has nothing to do whether it's factually true. And in a way, I suppose this is a thought that I had thinking about climate change 10 years ago, that in the end, it doesn't come down to a scientific argument. It comes down to a hunch that people have. It comes down to a gut feeling. And if people don't like your facts, they'll come up with alternative facts. And I think the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is the most, is the saddest and weirdest example of this being the case, because it was used as justification for pogroms. It turns up in Mein Kampf. Hitler talks about it. And down to the present day, it's still got adherents who say that it's a picture of how the world works.
Yeah, I mean, you say that there's no weapon as deadly as a typewriter. You also talk about fictions of difference.
Right. One of the things, the overriding things that I was interested in the secret books was in stories and how stories get weaponized. We have this idea that stories are these wonderful cultural artifacts that we pass to each other and we tell them around the campfire and their bridges and gifts. But actually, stories can be very sinister, as I think we've become more aware of in the past year or so. The stories can get used, they're self-serving, they can turn into weapons. And they can also be used to create a notion of an us and a notion of a them, which, as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was, which is, it can then be a justification for terrible acts. And I wanted to, as I say in the book, I wanted to show how stories arise, where they begin and how they end.
And of course, you say to be human is to make up stories and start fighting over them.
Right.
Finally, Marcel, you pose the question, what is an ending?
Right. We know that death is the ultimate ending, or at least if you don't believe in an afterlife, you do. And that's pretty much the only one that I can think of. We know as a story writer, though, you know that the endings are the hardest thing of all. And conceiving of an ending and bringing the reader to a satisfying ending is the hardest thing of all to do in fiction. And I think that's because true endings don't exist in the real world. Friends with the political philosopher John Gray, he's a really interesting guy. One of his ideas is that there's no such thing as progress, that life is not moving towards a point. And this really flies in the face of a lot of what politics is about and how we live our own lives. We always imagine that there's an ending up ahead where it's going to be bright and shiny. It might be worth sacrificing for. It might be worth sacrificing other people for. And John Gray's notion is this leads to a lot of tragedy and suffering. Whereas if you accept there is no ending, then you only have the present moment and you only answer political questions that speak to what do we really want now? Or, you know, what are the most pressing issues that face us? Is it climate change? Rather than building a new Jerusalem, you figure out how to stop people's homes getting flooded, you know, in the short and medium term. Unfortunately, for a novel, it's not satisfying to not have an ending. So I tried to construct the best ending I could, you know, and I always will. I think that is something that fiction gives you that life probably denies you.
The Secret Books, published by Faber and Faber, it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Daphne Karnitsis. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.